Human Insecurity describes the results of my 3-year sociological and ethnographic study of the Arab American and Muslim American experience after September 11th. The story is told primarily in the words of the people I interviewed. So when you read it, you're able to get a palpable sense of what that period was like for them. My job, in addition to interviewing the 102 first, second, and third generation Arab Muslims living in metropolitan Chicago that I did interview, and conducting a set of longer range oral histories, was to find the patterns these interviews revealed and to organize what I found in ways that made common sense and theoretical sense. In order for these patterns that I describe in the book to be truly representative of the Arab and Muslim American experience and not stories of the exceptional, I selected people to participate in the study, with reference to notions of random sampling, because we got in the newspapers the kind of extraordinary stories, but really what was the normative experience? That's what I wanted to know. And so I had to select people to interview that really represented the Arab Muslim community in Chicago in all of its, characters. Many are wealthy, many are middle class, many are poor, some have a lot of education, some have very little education, right? So I interviewed people from, based on these criteria that I knew about the community, and what I knew about, who it was composed of, Palestinians, Yemenis, Lebanese, Syrians, Egyptians, Sudanese, Somalis, Moroccans, and Iraqis. These are primarily the people I interviewed. About half the people I interviewed were born in the United States and half were immigrants, and about 45% were women. In addition to the interviews and the field research, I also followed American culture, the cultural climate here after September 11th, as we would see on talk shows, news radio, sitcoms, in TV series, in films. And I vigilantly followed the statements and activities of the American government, who I go after first. I found that during the period 2001 to 2005, each new government domestic security policy or strategy was collective in nature, meaning it targeted either all Arabs and Muslims in the United States, or all male Arab and Muslim immigrants who weren't yet permanent residents, or all mosques, or all Muslim charities. These policies were, very comprehensive and collective. In the book, I describe each of these policies, and I speak about their foundations in notions that Arabs and Muslims were somehow collectively culpable for the September 11th attacks. While not all Arabs and Muslims in the United States were seen as terrorists, there was an assumption behind these policies that they were people who applauded the attacks, who would readily provide cover for other would-be terrorists, or who would willingly financially support actions like that. In other words, the moral code of Arabs and Muslims was not the same as every other American. They were different. They were not like us. As long as enough Americans also shared this view, the government was free to target, profile, make well-televised arrests without credible evidence, and to hold prisoners over an extended period of time without due process. Once on this slippery slope of dehumanization, torture becomes something acceptable, and as we saw, it in fact did. Not in the United States, but by American authorities, although there is, abuse of these prisoners in the United States that has been documented by the government. Anyhow, that's in the book. Simultaneous to aggressive government actions, we had a significant spate of hate crimes, of hate actions, verbal insults, and widespread discrimination perpetrated against Arab and Muslim Americans, and people perceived to be members of these communities, because the first person murdered was a Sikh. Right after September 11th, somebody perceived to be responsible for these attacks. My book is about the effect of these policies and this cultural context on the lives of regular Arab and Muslim Americans who had to carry on with their daily lives, go to work, and raise their children in this context. I drew the title of the book, Homeland Insecurity, from the stories I collected in my interviews. Homeland insecurity was a pervasive social psychological state of fear and insecurity that was described by nearly everybody I interviewed. no matter they were born in the United States or immigrant, male or female, citizen, non-citizen, young or old. It was a sense of vulnerability that was palpable to me. People spoke of not feeling safe from the long arm of the federal government that had relaxed American standards of justice for members of their group. People spoke of being unable to feel safe in their own neighborhood, of being stared at in grocery stores, of being spit at in shopping malls, being harassed at work. But the ultimate insecurity was feeling that one's right to stay in one's home and homeland was in jeopardy. Majority of the persons I interviewed expressed fear that if another attack should occur, something they would have nothing to do with, public pressure would rise to do something about the American, Arab, and Muslim problem. And that might include mass deportations and internment camps. People were really afraid of being put in internment camps. As it was, more than 14,000 deportation orders were issued. And this is something really is not talked about in this country, as a result of one of these policies, the Special Registration Program. These deportation orders were not issued against terrorists or terrorist supporters. In fact, to be deported from the United States, you have to be cleared of terrorist connections. You have to be shown to have no criminal record, no terrorist record, right? Then you can be deported. Rather, these were people whose immigration papers were not in order. Of course, we have about 12 million such persons in the United States, but only people from Arab and Muslim majority countries were actually removed. I just wanted to read you a few quotes that kind of give you a flavor of homeland insecurity. One woman I interviewed said, I lost trust in American values, to put it very simply. I no longer have the serene sense that I will always be safe here. I feel that being an American citizen has become meaningless. It doesn't protect you in any way. It's an immense sense of danger, and I have never gotten over it. Can you believe it? I came home and told my husband, shouldn't we be putting our money in banks overseas? Maybe one of these days we'll end up in concentration camps. Another person I spoke to said, I suffered physically, no, but mentally and psychologically, yes. Primarily because I'm an American citizen, this sudden police state took me by surprise. It reminded me of what happened to the Japanese in this country. Another person I interviewed said, the attitude and the outlook was always there. It was just exaggerated, making you feel like you're the enemy, that you're the bad one, and you're a foreigner, and you do not belong in this country. When I was born and raised in the United States, and I'm just as American as anyone else, I feel like maybe I need to get the hell out of this country because something bad is going to happen to our people here. So that's a sampling of homeland insecurity. In my study, only a handful of Arab Muslims said their lives went unchanged after September 11th, and many said that life in the United States was no longer the same. And people still tell me this now. This turned the American experience in a certain way that made it just no longer the same. 63% of the people I spoke to said there are places they didn't feel safe. 46% said they personally experienced verbal assaults, and 10% were victims of hate crimes, half of which were property damage. In the book, I talk about this phenomenon. I just don't think you can tell the story of what happened if you just use, like, hate crime statistics, because that's not what it's about. It's not about how many people got, you know, shot or how many people got slashed. We had a guy who was slashed with a machete in the southwest suburbs, you know, but that really isn't the story. Those are the exceptional stories, right? I argue in the book that it was not the September 11th attacks alone that allowed these aspects of homeland insecurity to occur. Rather, it was the years of anti-Arab and anti-Muslim cultural and political propaganda that preceded the attacks that allowed them to be cast as a collective phenomenon, to be framed as something that most Arabs and Muslims would support, even if they didn't commit them. After all, following line with the stereotype, these are people from a culture that don't value life. These ideas have circulated through American culture long before September 11th, argued by a small group of people, but loud in their voice, and these ideas laid behind the government policies and the public behavior that focused on the collective. And in this way, it was very much like Japanese internment, which was not about Pearl Harbor. It was ignited by Pearl Harbor, but it was about anti-Japanese sentiments in this country, right? That's what caused internment. Indeed, it seemed as if quite a few high-ranking members of the Bush administration fully believed in these ideas. Many have noted that President George Bush visited a mosque shortly after the attacks, that he said Islam was a religion of peace, and he called on Americans not to hold innocent persons accountable. And these things are true. And I believe that for those people already receptive to hearing these messages, they meant something. But I argue it was the more frequent statements of, for example, his Attorney General, John Ashcroft, who often spoke in the language of us and them, that conveyed the messages that there were two peoples in the United States, one who needed to be protected from terrorists, and another group who should not be considered American, who therefore does not accrue the rights of being an American, who is potentially dangerous, and whose civil rights can be denied. Ashcroft's statements did little to discourage notions that Arab and Muslim Americans were different from everybody else. His statements, his policies, and the media's coverage of major terrorist arrests that eventually turned up no terrorists led many in the American public to believe that they should be afraid, that terrorists were hiding everywhere, and that the government was doing an effective job at finding them. So I'm just going to read you little snippets of a few of his statements. This one is shortly after the attacks. Attorney General Ashcroft said, "On September 11th, the wheel of history turned and the world will never be the same. The attacks of September 11th were acts of terrorism against America, orchestrated and carried out by individuals living within our borders. They live in our communities, plotting, planning, and waiting to kill Americans again." I mean, you know, you'd be scared if you heard something like that, right? I mean, there was no proof that that was the case, but that's what he said. Another statement. That's not it. Okay, this is kind of the us and them. I don't know if this is the us and them quote. Oh, well, anyhow, whatever. Here's another Ashcroft quote. "Within days of the September 11th attacks, we launched this anti-terrorism offensive to prevent new attacks on our homeland. To date, our anti-terrorism offensive has arrested or detained nearly 1,000 individuals as part of the September 11th terrorism investigation." You think, wow, 1,000 people have been arrested already. "Those who violated the law remain in custody, taking suspected terrorists in violation of the law off the streets and keeping them locked up is our strategy to prevent terrorism." Now, what he doesn't mention here is that these 1,000 people were picked up randomly across the streets of the United States, mostly on the East Coast, but not totally. They were people who happened to have a certain skin color, a phenotype, you could say, that looked like the terrorist phenotype, which is an Arab-Muslim phenotype. And they, when he says, taking suspected terrorists in violation of law off the street, the laws they violated were immigration laws. Their visa had expired. Something like that. But he's using this language to lead people to believe that these people are terrorists. Another quote of his that I think is very interesting, on September 18th, he said, "To date, the FBI has received more than 96,000 tips and leads, 54,000 on the website, 9,000 on the hotline, and 33,000 generated in FBI field offices." Imagine this. What does this mean? This means that 96,000 people assumed to be Arab or Muslim were called in by their neighbors or co-workers as being potentially terrorists. This gives you an idea of the depth of the stereotype. Okay? And how would you like to live in that environment when people, that's how they see you? That is the lens through which they are seeing you. Okay. Done with that. Such tips, the, like these 96,000 tips, were followed up by the FBI or other law enforcement visits to people's home and places of work, further stigmatizing them. So now you see the FBI at your neighbor's house. Aha, right? It produces more stigma. The notion of the threat then appears real. Many of the persons I interviewed were visited by the law enforcement authorities because a neighbor or coworker had called and reported they were acting suspicious. They were reported for activities such as making an overseas phone call, checking their mail more than once a day, opening their trunk too many times, or simply because they changed the way they dressed. They stopped wearing a headscarf, they started wearing a headscarf. These kinds of changes in the way people dress provoked calls to the FBI. Imagine how uncomfortable you would feel if you thought your neighbors and coworkers were watching your every move. The book provides a detailed account of these experiences so you can read them for yourself, and so they are recorded for history. And it's also about, you know, going into bookstores and going into libraries and going into banks and being told you can't open a bank account and feeling that the librarians are watching the books you're taking, right? It was a very pervasive climate of watching, and the government was encouraging everybody to watch. The book also points out, however, that not everybody had a terrible experience, and many Arab and Muslim Americans reported great acts of kindness from their neighbors and coworkers. In addition, many American civic and community organizations mobilized quickly to defend Arab and Muslim rights in the United States. These actions in support of Arab and Muslim Americans were one of the truly positive outcomes of this era. Okay. So I think most of us know that life was not pleasant for Arabs and Muslims in the U.S. after September 11th. But I think we all agree that these experiences have to be recorded for the historical record. But I want to spend the rest of my time here summarizing and really, really summarizing some of the things I found and write about that are additions to this narrative. Among other things, in the book, I answer the following questions. Did all Arabs and Muslims have the same experience? No. Did it matter where somebody lived? Absolutely. There's a chapter of the book that talks about this. People who lived in areas where there were few other Arabs and Muslims had the least problems. People that lived on the southwest side in a heavily Arab and Muslim community, but that had been organized by community organizers for years, so they knew their neighbors, they knew their white neighbors, they knew their black neighbors, they knew their Latino neighbors, right? I mean, they knew each other, and when people know each other, stereotypes don't stick as well, right? They experienced very little backlash after the first week. And the worst place was the southwest suburbs of Chicago, places where there is a heavy Arab and Muslim, heavy and growing Arab and Muslim American presence among a majority white community. And I'm going to get back to that in a minute. Was social class a key variable? Well, perhaps not in the way we expect. The middle class were actually the most affected. Not the lower class, the low-income people on the southwest side, not the wealthy people in, you know, Naperville or Hoffman Estates or wherever. Were there significant differences between men and women? Absolutely. I'm going to come back to this. Men were the targets of the government. Women were the targets of the public. Was being an immigrant different from being American-born? Mainly for men, because they had less civil rights. For women, if they wore a headscarf, it did not matter whether they were born in the United States or born outside, because they were treated as foreign and a threat. How many homegrown terrorists were caught during this period of intensive scrutiny and bending of the rule of law? Very, very few. Of all the cases that finally went to trial, terrorism-related cases, there's studies done at North NYU and Syracuse University, and a number of different law schools have followed these cases. And they only get a sample of the cases, because a lot of these cases are still sealed by the government. In fact, we still don't know who those 1,000 people were that were arrested. Those names are sealed. Anyhow, the median sentence for convictions on terrorism-related charges, 6 months. So people, in the end, were getting convicted of, like, signing a lease for somebody else, or writing a bad check. I mean, in the end, that's where those terrorism cases went. What was the impact of the production of domestic terrorists on the Arab and Muslim experience? Well, it was very substantial, because when you knew that it didn't matter if you did anything wrong or not, and it didn't matter if you were guilty or innocent, you still could be picked up and put in jail for 6 or 8 or 9 months before you could contact anybody. And even if you were cleared when you got out of jail, nobody would speak to you because they were afraid to talk to you. The impact was very substantial, that in fact there were so many arrests, but so few terrorists. What were some of the ultimate outcomes of this period for Arab and Muslim Americans? Are they more alienated or more integrated? Does the future look good or bad? I'm going to return to this at the end. Okay, so there's just kind of 2 points I'm going to focus on before I stop talking. Did men and women have the same experiences? Well, men were definitely the targets of the government's security policies. But my study found that women experienced threats from the American public in the forms of attacks and harassments at more than twice the rate of men. 65% of the women I interviewed said they personally experienced a physical or a verbal hate act. And I'm calling hate act because, you know, not everything that's done to people that's violent, has a violent thought behind it, is a crime. So I don't focus on the word crime. I call them hate actions. Okay. 65% of the women I interviewed said they personally experienced a hate act, but only 30% of the men. This finding really caused me to wonder if fear of terrorists and terrorist violence is sparking all this hate, why are women the focus of the attack? So, you know, I reread the interviews and the quotes, and, you know, they have these long stories. And upon further analysis, I found 2 interesting patterns. First of all, the majority of women who reported experienced hate acts were wearing headscarves or were in the company of somebody wearing a headscarf when the attack occurred. A woman wearing a headscarf was present in more than 90% of the hate incidents that were reported to me. And more than half of the men who reported a hate act also were in the presence of a woman wearing a headscarf. Women wearing headscarves were more likely than other women and than men to be spit at, to experience road rage, to have items thrown at their car, to be followed by strangers, to be subjected to hateful language, and to have their homes vandalized. We may safely conclude that the headscarf was what brought on these attacks, but why? Attacks on women in headscarves were commonly reported in the U.S. media after September 11th, and they were interpreted as being caused simply by the ready identifiability of these women as Muslims. Ah, she's got a headscarf, she's a Muslim, let's go after her. That is, women in headscarves were attacked, so the story goes, simply because they were easy to pick out. I provide a different explanation for this pattern of attacks. And I am able to do so because I know where, when, and how these attacks occurred. They occurred overwhelmingly in places where Arab and Muslim men were ready, available, visible, and identifiable. They occurred predominantly in the majority white Southwest suburbs. Plenty of Arab and Muslim men to attack down there, and easy to identify. Plenty of businesses to attack. I mean, there's plenty of options there, religious institutions. In my view, women were chosen. They were selected for a reason. And I argue that in these areas where women were, most prevalently attacked, Muslim and women in headscarves were chosen because they were viewed as symbols of the cultural threat that Arabs and Muslims were said to pose to the neighborhood and, in the larger scale, to American society and culture. According to portrayals in American popular culture, the hijab, or the headscarf, is understood as a symbol of male domination, of patriarchy, of authoritarianism, and of female oppression. Women who wear headscarves are the subjects of pity, or contempt, or anger. As such, their humanity is lessened, and they are constructed as inferior human beings. Indeed, It is at about this time that our government and voices in our country were arguing that we needed to invade Afghanistan to save the women. But you cannot save someone you don't respect. And voices of respect for Muslim women have been hard to find in our culture. Returning back to the southwest suburbs, women in headscarves were attacked, I argue, because they were seen to represent acceptance of or submission to a culture that was perceived as backwards, as uncivilized, as one that lacks freedom and has domination of women as, at its very core. The very culture that was seen to be invading the southwest suburbs. Women in hijab were understood by those who shouted at them, spit at them, sneezed at them, pulled their headscarves off, bumped into their cars, whatever, as manifestation of the anti-American. In this scenario, it does not matter whether a woman chooses or is forced to cover her hair, because whether by force or by choice, such women are seen as actively rejecting American culture and its way of life. When perceived as supporters of an anti-American way of life, American women in headscarves are easily then transformed into aliens and enemies who can be ordered to go home. And most of the women talked about this, where these acts would always be accompanied by get out of this country or go home or go back to where you came from, right? And consider that, you know, at least half these women were born here. This interpretation of events explains why American flags so often accompanied incidents of harassment of women in headscarves, and why many women wearing headscarves purchased flags and placed them on their cars and on their homes. There was this kind of dance performance of flags going on, you know, where certain people were shaking flags at women in headscarves, saying, go home, you're not American, you don't have the right to be here. And then women wearing headscarves are saying, I'm just as American as you are, and I have the right to be here. You know, and I have some fascinating stories, but I just wanted to read this one. I think this is a very interesting quote about a woman who, okay, one of my friends was wearing a scarf, but not anymore. So here's a woman who took it off. Some women started wearing headscarves after this time. Some women stopped wearing headscarves. You know, all these different patterns emerge. Anyhow, this one says, one of my friends was wearing a scarf, but not anymore. Her neighbor put small flags at all of the houses on the block. And my friend said to her, why didn't you put a flag in front of my house? And the neighbor said, because you're a Muslim. And my friend said, I was born here and my husband served in the American military. And she went out and bought a big flag and stopped wearing the scarf. But, you know, there are stories of other women, you know, for example, this one says, my husband told me to take the scarf off. And I said, no, I'm wearing it for my religion and I'm not bothering anybody and nobody should bother me. So you have this kind of range of responses to the headscarf phenomenon. These post 9/11 gendered patterns produce significant differences for the experience of Arab Muslim women and men. For men, the primary subjects of government security policies, non-citizen status made them more those who were not citizens were more vulnerable than citizens. But for women in headscarves, citizenship status had no relationship to their vulnerability because all women who were wearing headscarves were treated as foreigners. And while the men told me they felt least safe when they were traveling or in places where they knew no one, women told me they felt least safe in their own neighborhoods and at their own shopping malls. Okay, so I'm going to conclude by addressing just some of the outcomes of this period that are positive. In my view, despite all the terrible things that occurred, there were some positive outcomes. One was an increase in Arab American and Muslim American civic engagement and activism. Majority of people I spoke to said that activism was essential at this time. They had to become active to defend their rights. This was more likely to occur among the American-born than immigrants and among women than men, but people viewed it as absolutely essential for community defense. It also occurred because of this range of American organizations that actually stepped up to defend the rights of Arab and Muslim Americans and wanted to kind of incorporate them into their work. A second positive change, increase in knowledge seeking among some members of the American population, and a social response to these demands for knowledge. Many social institutions like schools and public libraries began organizing events about Islam, about women of Islam, about Arab culture to satisfy public, desire on some parts of the public to actually learn more, who knew that what we're being fed is, you know, isn't accurate. So what is accurate? And the beginning of some positive Arab and Muslim characters on TV, although this is kind of complicated because, as one of my colleagues who studies this said, well, now you have the good Muslim and the bad Muslim. You don't have a full range of human beings like everybody else. You know, you get two types. But these are some of the paradoxical outcomes of September 11th for Arab and Muslim Americans, and in my view, decades of political exclusion and stereotyping without contest have changed. The stereotyping is there, but I think it's more contested now. I think there's more than one narrative now. Finally, how did these attacks and their aftermath affect the religious faith of Muslims? Well, it's interesting that the majority of people I interviewed said they became more religious after September 11th. And this includes people who were religious and people who were secular. How did this happen? Well, you know, they wanted to understand their religion more for different reasons. I mean, one was how could these hijackers use Islam to justify attacks. I want to understand that. The other one is, everybody I know is asking me about my religion, and you know what? I don't know enough about my religion. Both of these kind of need to know more on the part of Muslims caused them to delve kind of deeper into their religion, to read the Quran more, to learn more, and they came out of this with actually a better appreciation of their religious faith. They understood it more. Okay. So in conclusion, I conducted this study so we as a society would know what happened to Arab and Muslim Americans during this period. If such histories are not written, they are easier to forget and to be repeated. It is my hope that one day the official American narrative about September 11th, the one that will appear in history books and will be taught to our children, will include not only the narrative of Americans living in fear of Arab and Muslim terrorists, but will also speak to how Arab and Muslim Americans had to live in fear because stereotypes were allowed to rule the day. Thank you. So I'm happy to answer questions. Yes, sir.
Do you know how what you found in Chicago, metropolitan Chicago, relates to what was going on in other regions or other large cities? And the other question is, I can't remember when you did this study.
I did the interviews between 2002 and 2005.
So do you know of anything happening from 5 to 2010 that would be of interest?
Okay. Comparative with other parts of the country. Well, you know, honestly, only two major studies were done after September 11th. One was mine, which is an ethnography, and one is a survey that was done in Detroit called the Detroit Arab American Survey. And they also have a book out called Crisis. Oh, God, I'm sorry. Well, anyhow, they're my colleagues. I see it all the time, so I didn't put the title in my head. Anyhow, you know, and survey research, interestingly, produces very different kinds of data than actually talking to people and getting their own understanding of events. But other than that, unfortunately, we have kind of what I was talking about as the exceptional stories. I mean, there are many reports like that where you can get stories of people who had some really bad experience. But a kind of overall portrait, no, there are no others. Since 2005. Well, I don't know that I could address that very quickly. That's a large universe. As I said, though, I think people still don't feel fully comfortable. I think since, this is actually the topic of my next work, so I think since the Fort Hood shootings, the onus of what we might call criminalization or stereotyping is now on the second generation. So this post-September 11th period, it was a lot about immigrants, right? And Arab immigrants are threatening, or Muslim immigrants are threatening. But since Fort Hood, because that person was born here, there's kind of this new discourse or narrative that, you know, the children of these immigrants aren't loyal to the United States. So that's kind of what I'm starting to look into now, where that comes from. And, you know, does one case make, you see, there's one case, Fort Hood, and now we suddenly have a statement that, again, is collective. So this trend towards collective explanations, I don't think has gone away. And the people that really are for those statements, who have their own political interests, they have not gone away. You saw what happened, I think, when President Obama ran for office, right? I mean, you saw the Muslim baiting and the Arab baiting and that distribution of that Obsession DVD that happened not in Chicago but in Milwaukee and 100 cities where the contest was, where the race was contested. A free copy of this movie called Obsession, which is about Islamic terrorism, was placed in the newspaper. So we got one in Milwaukee at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Everybody got a copy of this in like the end of October, right before the election. So there are people who leverage this hatred and fear for political benefit, and that has not changed.
Please repeat the questions.
I think I did, didn't I? Doing the best I can. Yes. Yes.
So I don't know what the age range of people that you were, but I'm curious whether young people in particular actually are radicalized. You know, it puts them in a position of all of a sudden being where they might have been very pro-American or very patriotic of all of a sudden, you know.
Okay, so the question is about youth, and did these experiences radicalize them? Well, what I can say, who knows about the IRB, the Institutional Review of Poor and Human Subjects? I couldn't interview anybody under 18 because I did not have permission to do that. But my next study will be, so I'll have to go through all those hoops. You see, there were countervailing trends. So that trend of civic activism and engagement was also very strong, whether it was demonstrations or meetings or, you know, I mean, I think that there were a lot of energies pulling people to get involved, which I think would be a countervailing impulse to, I don't think we should use the word radicalism. Which can we use that is used for other human beings? See, because Arabs and Muslims always have the own terms are applied to them, and then everybody else gets some other term. Alienation, let's say. I think alienation is a term that is used for every human group. But, you know, I mean, that's what I want to study, actually, is alienation and liminality and these kind of things.
Go into Afghanistan,
somehow
we're going to fix things, and that's what it does, is only to activate people to be anti.
Yeah, but I think in the Arab American and Muslim American community, those skepticisms about American foreign policy are so long. They go back so far, Israel, Palestine, Egypt, Lebanon, you know, Iraq, where do we begin, right? So sanctions. So this kind of critical perspective on American foreign policy would not be anything new. Okay, let's see. 1, 2, 3. Okay, go ahead, sir.
I don't know if you're aware of the International Visitor Center. They bring,
yes,
12 lawyers, but then, you know, from Palestine, from Saudi Arabia, and I belong to this organization, and they were doing talking about their experience here. They were all young, they were all beautiful, mm-hmm. I think they were all of well-to-do families, mm-hmm. and they were asking them, what did you think, you know, living here 6 months at the presidential tower, and they were assigned to different law firms, and it was interesting to hear their experience, what they encountered in Chicago. They were actually, well, they didn't say there was not one negative Mm-hmm. They all spoke very good English, mm-hmm. but they were wearing headscarves, mm-hmm. some of them, and some of them were wearing jeans, you know, from Morocco. But it really, and there were people from Palestine, from mm-hmm. Israel, mm-hmm. and they put them together. They had three per room, and they stayed here for, I think, 6 months. And they do this every year. And it was kind of interesting to hear what they had.
Yeah, I mean, and that, I think, would totally fit with my understanding, this description of 12, let's say, visiting lawyers staying in presidential towers, working in professional law firms downtown. That doesn't surprise me. They were living in presidential towers, which is downtown, and the downtown Chicago had the least amount of any kind of negative reports. They're working in professional firms. Professional firms tended to have the least amount of reported discrimination. Yeah, everybody did not have the same story. That is for sure. I'm trying to give you a kind of overview here. Okay, who was next? Oh, yes.
I just wonder if there's any attempt to connect this group's experience with the experience of other groups in American history. You know, like the Germans in World War I,
right.
The Irish certainly at the end of the 19th century, and the Jews during the 20s and 30s.
I think another set of my colleagues who are at CUNY, who have a book called Backlash 911, they do connect these. They have that historical perspective. They talk about, certainly about Japanese, and I know they talk about Japanese internment, and I assume they talk about other collectivizing.
That it may be a feature of American life.
Maybe a feature of human life, or sometimes you wonder if it's a feature of Western Christian society. Excuse me for saying that, but most of this stuff, these big genocides and collective, I mean, if you look at the history books, they tended to have occurred in the West and in Christian societies.
But we don't know the history of China.
No, and I certainly don't. Yeah. Okay. But, you know, we get the, you know, things that aren't translated, it goes both ways, right? Yes.
And then my question is just kind of, you listed some nationalities that were that you had interviewed, but I'm curious how exactly you define Arab and Muslim.
Yeah.
Especially so far, you know, I think it's kind of proud that people assume that they know what that means.
Right.
Right. And there's so many sources to, like,
right.
Humans getting killed, right?
Right.
Or like the Nigerian man, right? All the
right.
people are real, and there's Muslims in Nigeria.
Right.
It's just kind of like that.
Yes, that's a good question. How do I deal with the slippages, the conflation of Arab and Muslim? Well, I deal with them, I would say, as best as I can in chapter, I think it's 3. Those are complex topics, right? And I tried to explain my understanding of these complexities, and yet why I interviewed only Arab Muslims. And so I had to explain why I did that, and why I did that is because that's the people I knew best. And this was a period of time where everybody was afraid, and so you really, it wasn't a time to, for me to go venturing out into new communities and asking if I could knock on doors and talk to people. I mean, I really felt like I had to work in communities that trusted me, and that's why I chose that boundary. But I also said that I felt that this story, because so much of this period was based on stereotypes and phenotypes, because we are a racialized society, right? So people are interpreted. There is this terrorist phenotype in this society, and it's like a brown skin color and black, right? I mean, we all know the picture that goes with it. And this story is really about perceptions of people, right? So, and women in headscarves. So, you know, that would be like a whole nother talk if I went into the complexities of race and conflation and the difference of Arab and Muslim. And I did study, excuse me, oversample Sudanese and Somalis. And I did this because I wanted to see if being black and Muslim produced any kind of difference that I could understand. But what they told were the same stories, pretty much, especially when it involved U.S. government policy, because that was comprehensively focused. But they also had a lot more violence inflicted on them. But I must say that most, well, not all, but many of them were men, and they were taxi drivers. And it becomes hard to separate out what was caused by being a taxi driver and what was caused by being a Muslim from sub-Saharan Africa, right? So I mean, I did kind of try to probe that a little bit. Go ahead.
Did your research look into the role of the mainstream corporate media and public media, like national broadcasting, in either reinforcing stereotypes or failing to provide an alternative story that might have countered stereotypes that people were acting on?
The question is about the media, and did I look into the American media and its role in perpetrating stereotypes? You know, there are other people who do that for a living and do it probably better than I. I'm a people person. I like to be with people and talk to people. I do use quotes, however, from the media to kind of illustrate the conceptions people have and the kind of stereotypes they're being led by. So I do use pieces of media, but other people are studying the media. Who else had a... Yes?
I have two questions. First one is, why did you decide to write about this object?
Uh-huh.
And the second one is, if you ever felt threatened while you were conducting the interviews or while you were writing?
You know, my students complain that I'm like a hard ass and I'm not friendly enough, and I never feel threatened. I have to learn to be, maybe to look less threatening. No, I never felt threatened. Your first question, no, I'm sorry. Why did I do this? Well, you know, that's kind of another long story, and I don't want to belabor it, but, you know, you read that Tribune article. that told that story, right, on why I did this. You know, I think it's really my fate. I mean, I just kind of fell into this work. I've been doing this work for 25 years. I've been writing about Arab and Muslim Americans since I was a doctoral student at Northwestern. And why? There's no reason. I went to Morocco. I was like, wow, I've almost got a PhD and I know nothing about another culture that's not Western. And then I went to the library and I took out books and they were like racist. And I'm like, okay, there's a problem here. And then I studied immigrants because, you know, that's a fascinating topic to me. So it's my fate. There's no logical explanation for it.
Can we have time for one more question? Someone else.
No, ma'am, you may go.
I've been really aware in the media right now what's going on in France with the full Chador, whatever they're trying to put this through. And the comment that I heard the other day that was so interesting was, you know, it's a Muslim French woman saying this is a tiny percentage of our women, tiny, tiny, but they're making such a huge deal out of it. Do you see what we've seen in this country for so long as exponentially growing in Europe as anti-Arab, anti-Muslim sentiment? Are you aware at all? Are there any parallels?
Okay. Europe parallel. Europe is so much worse than the United States. You can't even begin to compare. It's so much worse. And one of the reasons, I believe, is because most, but not all, of the Muslims in Europe are guest workers or were people brought in after World War II to rebuild. In other words, they were people brought in and seen as inferior, number one. Number two, in most countries in Europe, they were never given citizenship. They have a very different rights standard. This is different in Germany, and it's different in the Netherlands, it's different in France. Every country has a different policy. But in general, there was never an idea that Moroccans in France should become French. You know, or Senegalese in Belgium should ever become Belgian. There was never, when they were invited to come work, there was never a concept that they would be welcome to stay or that they would have, or that, or the Turks in Germany. It was never an idea that we should give them citizenship, because they are not us. They are not German. They are not us. And we will not take them in. And so increasing pressure over the years has been made to accord people in these countries some rights. But very different situation in the United States, where we have a, people came as, you know, immigrants, you know, a whole different host of reasons, a whole different, a whole range of education levels. The vast majority can, you know, matriculate to citizenship. There's more of a multicultural sense of what being American is. It's not like being French, right? I mean, that's a very different concept, or being Dutch. So my worry is that these people who like to foment anti-Muslim sentiments in this country, they want us to go there because they thrive on this hatred. And so, like, I'm speaking at Columbia University on a panel about Muslims in the U.S. and France, and you can see what the topics are that people are trying, they're trying to push the paradigm, but I reject it. So, okay, well, thank you, everybody. Thanks for coming.